I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is Dr. Peter Enns, and he teaches at Eastern University in the Biblical Studies Department. And he's written many books, some academic and some for general audiences. And today, we're going to be talking about his newest book, The Sin of Certainty, not to be confused with maybe a more exciting book called How to Sin with Certainty. But that could be a part two, perhaps, Peter. But yeah, thank you.
Probably not. Anyway.
That would be the like New York Times bestseller right immediately. But thank you so much for sharing some of your time with me and being on my show.
Sure, Lisa. Great to be here.
How do you introduce yourself?
I don't know. I mean, it's just, you know, like when I'm speaking in front of people, they usually introduce me. And I don't really know when I introduce myself that often.
So if you went to a party and someone said,
"Oh yeah, well, I teach at Eastern University. Oh, what do you teach? Well, I teach in the theology department, and I teach a lot of classes on biblical interpretation. So it gets longer. That's a longer sort of introduction, but that sort of space it. Like I teach in college. Okay, I got that. There's a department called theology. Okay, I think I understand that. And within that, I teach how to understand the Bible. So. You know, but again, I'm very aware of how the fact that just the word Bible alienates people because, you know, biblical studies, they think, is it a Bible study? Is it like, you know, and it conjures up notions of fundamentalism, which I'm trying not to do, you know. So how do you do that? Well, that's you know, I almost don't care how you introduce it. It's all bad.
Right. And so what I noticed about your book is that it seems as though you've gone in a much more personal direction with this book. And I was interested to know sort of the path that took you to even write in this type of way and on this type of subject.
Boy, that's a big question. You know, I think I've been wanting to write books for what I call normal people, not academics, for a long time. And I started doing that sort of in the mid-2000s. But just, you know, as you know, the older you get and the more you think, the more you experience, certain things just become important to you. And one of which is connecting with other people and their stories, their narratives, and we all have them. And on my blog, you know, I began getting more personal about things that I know other people are experiencing. So I figured if I give voice to them, they'll want to chime in too. And that's certainly what happened. And that eventually led to a book like The Sin of Certainty, which isn't a memoir, but it's sort of flooded with personal experiences, good, bad, and ugly, that sort of shaped me into, you know, I guess you could say in the second half of life, that shaped me into wanting to think about my faith differently than I did before. And yeah, so there you have it in a nutshell.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, you're no stranger to controversy. For people who don't know you and know kind of your trajectory.
Yes, let's introduce them with my controversy, Lisa.
Let's do that. Let's start with scandal and work from there.
Yes.
But I know you've put out, you had been at Westminster, and I don't know all the nitty-gritty details. It's certainly not important to go into them, but you have approached topics that have ruffled feathers of conservatives. And I think that it's, you know, it's, I appreciate when people ruffle feathers. I think that sometimes the truth is the most, or I should say uncovering the truth is maybe the most controversial thing we can ever do, or just kind of shining the light on something that people have taken for granted. And, you know, obviously that would have really changed the trajectory of your scholarship and your career and even just your thought life. And I don't know if you want to just discuss a little bit about some of that and how that just shaped you and maybe in the direction you've been writing and things like that.
Well, yeah, just one thing to back up a little bit. You said, you know, uncovering truth is sometimes the most uncomfortable thing, which is true. But I'd put it a little less grandiose than that. I'd say that even suggesting alternate ways of thinking about something that are actually compelling to many people, that alone can be, it's not so much I have uncovered truth, but listen, there's a way of looking at this that actually makes a lot of sense to a whole heck of a lot of people. Mm. We need to take this seriously. And even that is resisted in some quarters. So, but yeah, here's the deal. I, like many people, I come from what you could say is sort of a centrist evangelical background, not terribly doctrinaire, but still very much a part of that. And, you know, I went to seminary, Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, where I learned an awful lot under some really good teachers. Like, some of your listeners may know people like Tremper Longman or Bruce Waltke and some other people. And it was really a very good experience. And they actually prepared me to keep my eyes and ears open for different ways of thinking. So when I went to Harvard and did my PhD, I was also sort of set up already for keeping a bit more of an open mind than maybe some others would. But even there, you know, I quickly found that alternate ways of thinking about the Bible, which conservatives tend to call liberal ways or secular ways of understanding the Bible, those are very, very compelling ways of thinking, as they take into account an awful lot of data that I felt evangelicals generally have to sort of slip over or bury, or sort of, it's like, you know, when you press a beach ball and keep it underneath the surface of the water, and that, you got one, two, maybe three, but then you have four or five, and all of a sudden they start shooting up, and you know, you have to account for it somehow, and sometimes that gets stressful to sort of defend old ways of thinking. So yeah, I wrote this book, which came out in 2005, called Inspiration and Incarnation, with a very telling subtitle, Evangelicals and the Problem of the Old Testament, because the Old Testament, I think, is more of a problem than something that, because it's a problem because it doesn't fit very well into certain ways of thinking about the Bible that really is important to evangelicals. And you know, I did it, you know, to ruffle feathers. It would be wrong to say I wrote it for the purpose of ruffling feathers. I had a feeling that it would, but more outside of my institution than within, because I had been teaching these things at the school for 10 years already.
Yeah.
But while I was writing it, while it was being published, there was a turnover at the school administratively and otherwise, with people of a much more conservative mindset coming in and wanting to sort of shape the school differently. So I got sort of caught in the middle of something there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only a controversy because other people chose to make it one, you know, that's which happens sometimes. You know?
Yeah. And I think, and you've also been involved with speaking about Adam as, you know, not a historical figure, or thinking about the Bible in different ways and not thinking of it as the Bible is a historical piece, or the Bible is a scientific manual for us, and working with BioLogos. And maybe you could explain a little bit of what that has entailed, because that kind of adds a really interesting piece to your career and your life's work.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the thing that's gotten the most attention just sort of out there in the blogosphere. But yeah, I wrote a book a few years ago called The Evolution of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about how Adam's been understood among Christians, and that becomes into conflict very much with evolution. Evolution says there is no first person. Genesis says there was. And how do we bring those two things together? And the basic gist of the book is that we don't bring them together because they're speaking two very different kinds of languages. And in fact, even understanding Genesis is sometimes the problem among you know, certain conservatives. And that's the thing that actually needs to be looked at again. Very often, you know, you look at the topic of the Bible, people of faith at least look at the topic of the Bible and evolution. They say, well, I know what the biblical story is about, and how do I get evolution to fit into it?
Mm.
My point, you know, as a biblical scholar is you might be getting the Genesis story wrong all by itself, right? It may not even be talking about a first person. For example, you've got, you know, people, male and female, are created in Genesis chapter 1. Then in Genesis chapter 2, God creates Adam. And you think, well, how do those two things work together? You already have people, yet he's creating somebody else. And then Adam and Eve, you know, they get tossed out of the garden, and Cain kills Abel, his younger brother, the famous story, and then he runs out because he's afraid of a posse coming after him. And like, where do these people come from?
Right.
If Adam and Eve are the first two people, where are they? And then he goes and he marries a woman and he builds a city. What woman? Where? And a city is for people, not for a couple. So you have all these questions that come up that make the Adam story not at all an obvious story of what the story is even trying to do. And I sort of take a page out of medieval Jewish readings of the story that sort of parallel Adam and the people of Israel, which I find very, very intriguing. Adam was created by God out of dust, and he's placed into the Garden of Eden, which is this idyllic, paradisical, you know, land flowing with milk and honey. Actually, no, I slipped there. That's actually the promised land, which we'll get to in a second. But it's a land that's a paradise-like land. And he stays in the land as long as he obeys the command of God, which is not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he eats of it, and God says, on the day you eat of it, you shall die. Well, on the day of eats of it, he doesn't die, but he's exiled from the garden. And that story very much is almost a preview of Israel's entire struggle with God. They're created by God out of the dust of slavery. They're placed into the lush land of Canaan, which is an Eden-like land. And they're given commands to obey, which is the law of Moses. And if you obey the commands, you stay in the land. If you break the commands, you are exiled to Babylon, which is referred to as death in the Bible and in several places. Mm-hmm. So Adam, to me, seems more like a metaphor or almost a table of contents for the whole book. Like, this is the pattern that we Israelites have experienced that goes back to the very dawn of time. Mm. Part of this thing that's been happening for a very long time, which is basically not listening to God.
Mm-hmm. And the whole thing reads like poetry in how the literary structure is formed there. As you read it, it doesn't read like a linear story. Like you're saying, it goes back and forth and has chiastic structure and mm-hmm. and has all that. It's all not a factual A, B, C, D, E, F, G story. It goes in a pattern. And you're
right. What that suggests, Lisa, and not to interrupt, but what that suggests is a very important point. It's not that the ancient people were like stupid or idiots or just mm-hmm. they believed little children's stories. These stories are artistically mm-hmm. written, and they're very thoughtful pieces of theology, mm-hmm. but not history. Mm-hmm. And I have to think that the ancient Israelites who wrote this stuff actually understood that what they were doing, and mm-hmm. they weren't saying, let's be scientific and historically accurate about it. Let's write about how things happened. Mm-hmm. They're telling their own story. Mm-hmm. They're telling the story of Israel mm-hmm. and putting it back into primordial time. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fascinating piece of theology. It shows us something of their ideology. Mm-hmm. And to look to see, well, you know, Adam must have been the first person because the Bible says so, is frankly a very naive and almost childlike reading of the story mm-hmm. that I think the biblical writers themselves wouldn't have supported.
Yeah, and it's even just picking the name Adam, itself, and it means what, the man?
Or yeah.
You know, it's like the man. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds symbolic to me. But it's also, you know, we're talking about a story about identity, and then you're right, the paradise, the exile, it's this theme that is this thread throughout the entire Old Testament. And right. It just kind of look at it in like a, and here's our science book. For the earth,
exactly
it's just a little weird. And so, you know, there's obviously a modernist mindset kind of superimposed back on this mm-hmm. ancient text that I find completely baffling once you actually, like, my context was literalism in my upbringing, but once you actually start looking at, I don't know, science, and you think, well, that has to be, something else might be going on here. And then you realize actually ancient writers really wrote differently. So something has to get reconciled.
The irony is that literalism is a modernist reading strategy.
Mm.
It's not medieval Christian. Medieval Christians had all sorts of ways of reading the Bible that were rather mystical or contemplative and not literalistic. Mm-hmm. And that's the irony, because what many think is that their literal way of reading the Bible is the way it's always been done. And all you have to do, I mean, forgive me, is read the Bible, and you see this is simply not the case. You can see how Old Testament writers used earlier texts in their own writings. I mean, like, you know, the very tedious books of First and Second Chronicles, and how they sort of, these books recapture and rewrite Israel's history that you find in like First and Second Samuel and First and Second Kings. Look at how Paul adapts his Bible, which Christians call the Old Testament, for saying something very, very different. These were not, if they were anything, they were not literalistic readers of their text. Mm-hmm. And so literalism is not normal. It's not the default mm-hmm. position. And I always find that very, very ironic that the most conservative way of reading the Bible is actually utterly unbiblical.
Mm. Yeah, it's revisionist. It's really fascinating to me. And I guess and maybe to switch gears a little bit, one of the things I wanted to ask you about your latest book, because as you're talking about the sin of certainty, and you know, I was reading some of the reviews on Amazon, and almost everybody is just totally embracing your book and really appreciating. And I would also recommend that anybody who feels guilty about having doubts just really, really get this book. It's very liberating if you feel like guilt prone about having doubts. But as I was reading I would love to first hear what you think about when you write the word God, because this is going to sound like a really, really strange question, perhaps, but we all have, you know, if you read someone reads the Old Testament, they're going to think about God in certain images. If they read the New Testament, maybe perhaps they'll think of God in other images, and everybody seems to have a different concept. But as you write about God in your book, it seems very objective, and I'm sure that it's your concepts and ideas and thoughts about God have evolved over time. But yeah. as you some of your sentences are structured and as some of your concepts are put out there, you'll say God is this and God is that. And so I'm kind of thinking, well, when you say God, what are you envisioning? What are you talking about? And that's an awfully giant question.
I mean, that's almost the question, right? Mm-hmm. I'm working on it. I'm trying to be more self-conscious even of what I mean when I say God. And, mm-hmm. you know, God is a metaphor, right? You don't capture the creator in the word. And it's a conventional way of referring to whether we say the higher power, the creator, the divine being, whatever. All those words miss something. And I think I simply choose to use more of a conventional way that people understand. God is a word that doesn't need to be explained, and you can say, okay, we can at least have a discussion that, even though none of us can actually wrap our arms around what is entailed in this word. So, I wish I could do better than that, but I contemplated, and I did a little bit in the book, I would, you know, like say creator and with a capital C, or wise with a capital W, or things like that, to try to actually pick on biblical descriptors of God as, you know, in terms of the actions that this God performs in the Bible. And that's maybe a way forward. But I have to say, the more I thought about it, I don't really particularly like the word God. Mm. It's almost lazy. And it does have difficult connotations for people, you know? So, yes. And I'm wide open on thinking through that one. I'll tell you that, Lisa. I just...
Yeah. Well, it really is tricky, because when you're talking about, like, for instance, here's what I bump up against, and maybe as you've written about it and being a scholar, you can speak into this. But so I'm reading the Old Testament, and I'm realizing that this people group in this ancient time has all these presuppositions about gods, and, you know, coming from Egypt, there's, you know, polytheism, there's all this paganism going on, and they're talking about God in a very new way, non-image God, and they're talking about Yahweh, and you can't speak the name. It's very particular, you know, Semitic influences, and they're talking about God in ways we are not, as at least in the United States, American, capitalistic. We're just not talking about the same thing, mm-hmm. or we're talking about not talking about the same not thing.
Right.
And then in the New Testament, it seems like something else is emerging, and there's Greek influences, there's other things happening, there's other cultural influences. Mm-hmm. And so I find it really confusing, but I do notice that it's assumed, without examination, it's assumed all of us are assuming that, oh, the thing or the no thing that I'm imagining is just the same thing that, you know, that Samuel's talking about, the same thing that John the Baptist is talking about, the same thing that Paul's talking about. It. And it's really hard mm-hmm. to reconcile that. I know this is like my really long-winded question, but...
Yeah, I don't do therapy, Lisa. Just at least I charge for the hour for that.
Oh, no. The bill's coming in the mail. But as you... encountering this as a biblical scholar, like, how do we navigate all those points where obviously... what we're saying when we say God is radically different than these ancient Semitic people?
Well, you know, I think the first thing that I try to keep in mind there, and, you know, I talk to people about, and when it comes up, is that there is no one portrayal of God in the Bible. They actually differ. And, you know, I would argue strongly that, you know, the God portrayed in, say, Samuel Kings, maybe the book of Deuteronomy, isn't portrayed the same way that you find God portrayed in Ecclesiastes or Job, or, well, maybe Job a little bit more, but things like the book of Jonah or other places. You have, you know, Israelites thinking differently about God in different periods and different times, because their own understanding of God changes with their given circumstances, right? I mean, just think about normal people today who go through all sorts of periods of whether stress or crisis. Your theology changes. You think differently about God based on things that have happened to you. I see that all over the place in the Bible. And, you know, then you have the New Testament, and it's easy to sort of contrast the new and the old. And I think we should try to avoid that, because there are things in the New Testament, you know, assumptions about God that actually come out of this Jewish trajectory that was already happening in the Old Testament, you know, and in the centuries before the coming of Jesus, what conventionally referred to as the Second Temple period or the Intertestamental period. You know, we don't have books in our Bible written for the most part during that period, but that was a very fruitful theological period where they were thinking through things. Like, you know, is our God simply a national God, right? Because here we are, we're in our land, but we're run by the Persians or the Romans or the Greeks before them. And, you know, what does it mean to be the people of God? And so they had to think through, what does it mean to be a faithful Israelite here? And then later on, here and now, when we have, you know, superpowers running us and we don't even have our own king sitting on the throne in Jerusalem, the way it was back in the good old days. And then with the exile, you know, rather the destruction of the temple in AD 70, where the Jews were eventually, you know, expelled out of Jerusalem and then out of their own land, pretty much out of there until the 1940s, right? The Jews had to think about, what does it mean to be a faithful follower of God outside of the land, like we had to once during the exile back in, you know, the 6th century BCE. And, you know, Christians, the same thing. We have to, I mean, I see Paul doing this. It's absolutely fascinating to me how Paul, an educated Jew, is trying to make sense of Jesus when it's such a radical departure from what Jews were probably expecting. They were not expecting a Messiah who would be crucified. That's a sign that you're not the Messiah if you lose, right? And then raised from the dead, that made no sense to them back then. And now they believed in the resurrection of the dead, but that was going to happen one day way in the future to all faithful Jews, to all those who are faithful to Yahweh. That's what happened. But for Paul, the Messiah, one Jew was raised now instead of all Jews later. And I see Paul like wrapping his arms around that and just going into hyperspeed, like in the book of Romans and things like that. So, you know, I'm seeing in the Bible, in other words, evolution is not the right word, but developments and strands and trajectories of thinking about God that are actually fairly diverse, yet at the same time, they believed was consistent on a very deeper level, right? And so, you know, we come to things like the Old Testament where God seems angry a lot, you know, and he's, you know, like violence is the default mode of taking care of conflict resolutions. And the New Testament, you know, Jesus saying about not killing enemies and things like that. How do you bring those two things together? I think for me, it's rather simple. And I know it's not simple for everybody because it might take some hoops to jump through. But for me, it's rather simple. What we're reading in the Bible is the genuine perspectives of those who are living through it, communing with God in ways that made sense in their cultures, mm-hmm. right? If you're living in a tribal age, violent culture, you're probably going to have tribal warrior, violent gods, which is exactly what you see in the ancient world. I mean, Yahweh is a warrior in many parts of the Old Testament. Well, that's everybody had that. Everybody's high god was a warrior. Now, does that mean God is actually a warrior and he kills your enemies? Well, the whole history of the Christian faith has pretty much said no. It's not. That's we have to think of God's warfare against something else, like whether it's sin or whether it's the powers and principalities, as Paul puts it, you know, heavenly beings of some sort, whatever Paul means by that. But, you know, it's interesting to me just paying attention to what the biblical writers say in their context and letting it be different. So in our task is not so much how do we today connect with the biblical God, but allowing those diverse expressions of God in the Bible almost model for us how each of us individually or culturally, we do see God through our own lenses, for good or for bad. And we have to be very self-conscious of that. You know, when God is an advocate of family values, right, that is imposing upon God what a particular culture values.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, making God into, anything. We always see God in our own image, right? That's sort of the issue, and I think we see that in the Bible as well.
Well, does that point more towards then our human nature and our psychology just kind of projecting onto God what we would do just by nature of how our brain works and doing that? But then how do we actually pierce into what this true reality, what's really going on, right?
Well, you know, it's not just that we use psychology, we are psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all theology is psychology and sociology. Oh, no, that's horrible. No, because we're people. We're people living in community, and we're people with histories, with pasts, with brain chemistry, with just who we are. We can't help that.
Mm.
So, you know, I think those are just the inevitable markers of humanity, and we cannot escape them. And, you know, when you said how can we sort of peer through this to see the real thing? The answer is we can't, and we never will. And here's the twist of the Christian faith that makes it differ, I think, from any other faith, at least I'm aware of. God enters into the human picture and allows his children to tell his story from where they are, from their perspective. And I find that fascinating and vulnerable and risky, so to speak. Although I think from God's point of view, if I may speak for God, God doesn't take risks in that sense, but, you know, we are who we are, and I think the history of theology is littered with people wanting to transcend their time and place and almost have this Platonic view of up there someplace that I have access to where I can tell you what God is really like.
Mm. Right?
What God is really like for Christians is what we read in, you know, fundamentally in the New Testament, the story that Jesus tells about God, and we start from there. But we're always human creatures influenced by who we are and where we are and the people we hang around with. And we have to be aware of that. And as a result, our theologies, I think we need to hold them with maybe an open fist and not be so committed to how we happen to think about God right here and now. Because sometime in the future, somebody's going to come around and point out to us, you know, you're a white male American.
Mm-hmm.
Surely you must see that will have some effect on how you understand God, right?
Yeah.
And I think it certainly does, that in ways that I'm not even remotely aware of.
Mm. I'm not sure what an open fist is, Peter, but
yeah.
But
well, gently with Actually, I'm being really clever and zen-like when I say, but,
nice.
You know, it's with your hands. It you hold them. They're not just an open hand, like I don't care. They can whisk away. You want to hold on to them. But maybe with a gentle fist, you know, one that can be pried open without tremendous difficulty if you see reason to.
This just felt like a kung fu episode, and I'm grasshopper. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that is the really compelling, for me, the really intriguing and compelling image of the incarnation itself, that isn't that kind of what's going on with Jesus, that here's Jesus in messy human form, and yet the embodiment of God coming to the world to bring, not just coming into the world and poof, everything's better, but coming into the world and bringing healing and introducing a new kingdom and a new way of seeing the world upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what we do.
Right.
And so I guess that's kind of the force behind Christianity for me, compared to any other way of seeing the world or any other philosophy or way of looking at the world, is that the incarnational life is one where you wrestle with God or whatever that is,
mm-hmm.
and you do it backwards than the world would have us do it.
Right. Right. Counterintuitively.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is, I mean, I'm with you on that. That's the thing that sort of keeps me staying in the game when I get all analytical about my faith versus everybody else's faith. It also makes me want to sort of relax a little bit and not feel like I know everything, right? But yeah, certainly, we do the best we can, and Jesus is both our model, right, and our savior, and all those things can be talked about and understood what exactly that means. And I think what really, and this is a real sticking point, I think, for people, that, okay, Jesus is, you know, God in the flesh and messy and makes things rather messy. But it really does, because we can't forget that there is the full humanity of Jesus. Jesus was a first century Palestinian-based Jew. Not just human in the general sense, but human in a very particular, specific sense, who had assumptions and worldview ideas, so to speak, that he shared with his fellow Jews, probably unwittingly, because he was a real person, right? It wasn't Jesus was aware of every bit of his own psychology or sociology. Mm-hmm. And being the Son of God doesn't mean, in other words, he's omniscient. Or, yeah, I'm just sort of looking human, but I don't really mean it. I'm actually God walking around among you. It's the mystery of the incarnation, which is God-man, both the same, both mixed together, and that's the wrong word, but, the, you know, 100% of both, which is mathematically impossible. But that's the mystery of it, and that's what impels us, that even in the most concrete act of God that Christians believe, which is the incarnation, that alone is more messy than we sometimes want to, you know, think. And that's why Christians very often will say things like, well, Jesus was basically omniscient. He knew everything, or he's omnipotent. He could do everything. I'm not sure if we can speak that way of humanity, right? And Jesus was fully human. Well, what's the divine part? What's the human part? Well, I don't know if we can talk in parts. You know, I'm not sure if that's Christology in the true sense of the word. And I just, you know, you can go on and on, but I think the two most important issues for Christians, at least the ones that I hang around with, to get a handle on is, what is the Bible, and talking about Christology and what that means and what the implications are for us. Mm-hmm. I think they both fit together too. Mm-hmm.
And so in personal terms, how do you feel like your own concepts of God have evolved the most, like in the last maybe 15 years? Do you feel like things have shifted for you substantially?
Yeah, I mean, there have been substantive movements in how I think and how I perceive God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also because, you know, life happens and, you know, middle age and all that sort of stuff, that's pretty typical. But, you know, I'd say maybe probably the biggest thing is not thinking of my experience of God is not irrelevant. Why would anybody say that it is? Well, it's sort of implied in certain, you know, very conservative iterations of the church that God is actually filtered through your head. It's how you think, right? And I don't trust my thinking enough to sort of be like the gatekeeper for things. So, you know, I've just read people and talked to people about how the experience of God is a way of bypassing all those channels, in a sense, and just letting it be. And, you know, just, you know, when I'm enjoying something genuinely, it can be as simple as sitting in the backyard reading a book or just watching the leaves move. I think to myself, in the ancient world, these would be God moments, right? So why aren't they now? Because I'm a modernist. That's why. So let's transcend maybe that moment if I can, and just accept by faith that we have all different sorts of ways of perceiving and experiencing God. You know, I do think of God as, I guess, a being, but I don't know what that means. But I've been influenced also by others. For example, you know, Orthodox people I've just run into, you know, just a casual conversation talking about God as being, and not God as a being. Now, I don't really know what that means, but I like it. I'm attracted to the idea that, you know, I relate a story in The Sin of Certainty about a friend of mine who once challenged me, when you think of God, what do you think of? And I said, that's a stupid question. I'm not going to answer it. And he goes, no, I want you to answer it. Tell me physically, what do you think of when you think of God? And I said, well, I guess sort of off in the upper corner of a room and sort of this cloudy sort of blob I can't quite see through. And he said to me, that's your problem. You know, you think of God as up there and out there, sort of mysterious and inaccessible. And he said, you know, what if the Bible is right? He's more of a contemplative kind of Christian. Put out there. He said, what if the Bible is sort of right, that God is in you? And without God, there's nothing. And maybe God is even all around you, right? Think about that. And I said, and that makes a huge difference and how you walk through life. And those are ideas, just two of them, that I never would have probably been in the position of even thinking about were it not for older structures sort of giving way for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah. And older structures in it, within yourself, you're saying?
Yeah.
And really those concepts and ideas are so very old and more Eastern in the sense of like desert fathers and mothers.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It's interesting to, I guess for Protestants to sometimes wake up and realize that Christianity didn't start 500 years ago.
You know what I'm telling you, some people really do though. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember, I mean, I'm not going to tell more of the specific context, but I was in a meeting once with male church leaders where one of them was asked to pray. It was a rather large thing. And we basically prayed, "Oh Lord, you know, the church was in darkness until 500 years ago, and then you gave us the light again." It's all about the Protestant Reformation. Mm-hmm. That makes me ill to think of that. Like, this is, that's idolatry. That's making God into something that I think God isn't. But that is very much how, at least in my little universe, which is a little one, that I come across that notion more often than I'd like to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the sin of certainty that happens on all different sides. You know, it can happen in Catholicism, it can happen in Protestantism, it can happen in, you know, it can happen in a Harley Davidson club. You know, you know, if you like, we're the only bikes that exist. Right. But you know, it'll happen anywhere there's an ego, I suppose.
Right. Which is everywhere. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. When there's humans around, I suppose. But it's true that our hubris will really get in the way, and we'll assume, well, if I believe it, it's got to be true because I wouldn't believe something that's not true, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm also interested, Pete, to know what you plan for some of your next work, and where do you see some of your work going, if you could, or is that too secretive?
No. Yeah, I tell you, but I'd have to kill you. This is the first summer, as we're speaking here in 2016, this is the first summer where I haven't been actively writing one or more books at the same time. And because, you know, The Sin of Certainty came out in April, and I just decided, I don't really know what I want to say. You know, the books are about to write because I just really feel like I want to say something. And that wasn't hitting me. And I said, I need the summer just to remember who I am and to not feel like I have to crank books out just for the heck of it. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know. But, you know, I my world is like looking at the Bible from a different angle, right? And how that actually helps us think about our lives. So it might be something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And I've really begun thinking concretely about the past 2 or 3 weeks, but nothing, not a tweet that I could sort of give out here. Like, here's what I'm working on. I think that's a few months away. Mm-hmm. And when I know it, I'll know it.
Yeah. And then I'll have you back on.
That'd be great.
This has been really fun. I wasn't sure what we would end up talking about because there's so many things that you cover in your work, and you know, I've been reading you for a long time. I wasn't sure which way to go, but I figured that it would be a joy ride no matter what.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I had fun too.
And so, is there a place where people can find you that would be the easiest place? Like, is it on Twitter or just your website?
Yeah, Twitter. Pete Enns, and on Facebook too. And I forget if it's Peter Enns or Pete Enns. I don't know what it is because I have no idea what I do on Facebook. But also, my website is PeteEnns.com. Also, TheBibleForNormalPeople.com, which is too hard to type. So just PeteEnns.com will get you there. And you can see the stuff that I do. I blog fairly regularly. I mean, on a good week, 3 or 4 times a week. On a slow week, maybe once. But yeah, that's a good place to find out what I'm doing.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too.